This edition contains references to subjects which might cause distress or be upsetting, so listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to God in the Ordinary, a podcast to help you reveal God to others during your everyday. Special guests share their stories with songwriter and author Sharon Tedford.
Today's guest knows that the love of Jesus conquers all. He works with some of the most sidelined people in society and has seen them find freedom in Christ. He has a passion for those who are spiritually and physically incarcerated. My guest, Kairos Prison Ministry UK Chairman, Richard Stevens. I'm so delighted to introduce you all to Richard Stevens. Thanks for joining us, Richard. Can you tell us where you live, please?
Hi, yes, I live near Cambridge at a place called Bury St Edmunds in England.
So, Richard, tell us who you work for.
I'm the UK chairman of a prison ministry called Kairos Prison Ministry International, working mainly in America, founded in America, but now spreading across the world.
Thank you. And it's to that end that you've written your reflection on Isaiah 61. So could you please share that with us?
Yeah, I'd be delighted. Isaiah 61 is a message of hope written to the people in exile because of their sins, who are not dissimilar to the men I work with in prison, exiled from society in prison because of their crimes. And they need hope. You bet. The poor always need glad tidings. It is often said that before men offend, they are offended against. Most prisoners have had appalling childhoods, growing up with poor role models and poor moral guidance. They may never have known family love. Behind every cell door there is a broken heart. But Isaiah says Jesus comes to heal the brokenhearted and to set the prisoner free. This is good news for the men imprisoned not only by the physical bars that surround them, but by the psychological bondage to drugs and alcohol and to the toxic effects of the verbal curses they have received from angry parents, insensitive teachers, or unkind classmates when they were told that they were a mistake, a nuisance, stupid, or below average, or in so many ways, unacceptable. How they long to have a year or even a day when they are deemed acceptable to anyone, let alone the Lord. How they long for the comfort and consolation offered by the wonderful Counselor who heals wounds and who promises that their former life of ashes could be turned into something beautiful, filled with the oil of joy. On every Kairos Christian mission, the inmate participant experienced the outworking of these promises from Isaiah 61 and Matthew 11. The desolation from their generational curses evaporates. Their spirit of heaviness is dispelled by the power of his love and replaced by the garment of praise. Those who have been spiritually blind see for the first time who God is, who they are, and whom, with his help, they can become. Society's lepers feel forgiven, washed clean by his redemptive blood, the spiritual dead are raised, and those crippled by life walk again, all done in 5 days in the chapel. These new oaks of righteousness will on release become the priests of the people. These ex-prisoners, now born again, can be the gospel light spreaders in the darkest areas of the inner cities, where the mainstream churches have never fully penetrated. The harvest and the glory will be God's.
Wow, Richard, thank you so much for that reflection. That was profound and meaty, and I know I'm going to have to go back and listen to it over and over to learn some more things there. Thank you. So as we get started, could you please tell us a bit more about the general mission of Kairos, where it started, how it's growing, what it looks like?
Well, the word Kairos itself is a Greek word, and it means the right time. And the people on the ministry believe that the right time to talk to prisoners is when they're in prison, because that's where their rotors definitely hit the buffers, and that's where they're ready to hear the words of comfort that Jesus speaks. It started in America in about 1990. It came to England at the end of the 90s, and it's had a slightly up and down experience in England for various reasons. But in the last 10 years, it's come back again, and we're now operating in 5 prisons in the UK, around Northern Ireland, and also in and around Cambridge.
Thank you. So what happens at a Kairos event? How do you challenge wrong ways of thinking?
Well, the ministry itself lasts for 5 days. We have a team of trained Christian volunteers. We're all volunteers. We go in and we spend 5 days in the chapel with men of equal number. In other words, about 20 men come in at a time, and they marinate for 5 days, hearing a variety of talks, meditations and things from the team, which help them to understand something of Jesus's love and forgiveness.
So why do you start with Jesus's love? Is that an important foundation?
Well, it's very interesting. You can't talk to somebody about love unless you've shown it. And so one of the secrets of Kairos is we make about 10,000 cookies, homemade cookies by Christians, which get packeted up with a little sign saying made with love by Kairos. And we distribute those all around the prison to every single person in the prison and every staff member. You can't talk about the God of love to people without showing them. And so this becomes edible love. And that sort of sets the tone, because they can't understand why we're doing it. They come in on the first day and many of them say, you know, I'm only here for the cookies, in which case I just say, well, have a cookie. And they expect me to sort of be upset by that. But actually, that's the whole point. They're there because we want to show them love. And then we spend a little bit of time just getting to know each other. But the first significant talk is when we ask them to reflect about who they are, who they think they are, but not as they normally think, I'm a bank robber or I'm a murderer, but think about their strengths, because I think that's so important for them. We don't ever comment on or ask them why they've been in prison or how long they're here for. We just welcome them as people who are searching for a new way of living. And then the next important person is a talk on choices. And this is always given by an ex-offender on the team, talking about the choices they didn't have when they were children. They didn't have a choice that their father would never, ever see them again, because he would have deserted his mother as soon as she got pregnant. They didn't have a choice as to whether their favourite grandmother died of cancer, or their mum died of cancer, or they were put into care. They didn't have a choice as to whether they were abused as a child by their grandfather. But all these things have a huge impact upon them. And the very thing that they often think is, Richard, you're going to talk to me about a God of love. Well, where was that God of love when my father was beating my mother? And I say, well, where do you think he was? And they say, well, we think that he wasn't there, or he would have stopped it. But that's a narrative that has skewed their whole attitude towards life. And I say to them, well, I'll tell you where he was, really. He was there, he saw the whole thing. And he was crying and shouting at your father to stop him hurting you, his child. But unfortunately, your father was too drunk to listen. And if you want to know really where he was, when you were crying in your pillow for what your father had done to you, Jesus was weeping for you. And he's been weeping ever since. But today he's thrilled because they believe he's got your attention. And that, for the first time, helps them to realize that God was there and is on their side. And it helps them to understand his love. You can't talk about love to a person who's never known love, but you can certainly talk about a weeping God for a person who spent most of his 20 years weeping.
Wow. Wow, Richard, that's really great. I bet you've seen a lot of that over your years. I know that prison ministry is not an easy ride. I've done prison ministry, but not to the depth that you have. So what was the catalyst for you getting involved there? What was it that drew you to this ministry?
First of all, when I was 8, I was a thief. I say that way because it's not really true. It's not that I was a thief, it's just I stole. I stole pen knives. And my headmaster called me in. I wasn't very clever, because I hold pen knives from all the other boys in the school and hid them in my locker, which was a dumb thing to do if you're a criminal. But I was young at that stage. I didn't realise that you shouldn't keep your swag in your own property. And he found me and called me in, and there they were on the table. And he said to me, Richard, do you know something about this? And I absolutely was terrified, burst into tears. And I was expecting him to punish me, call for my parents, expel me. I don't know what was going to happen. But he looked at me very gently. He was a lovely Christian man. And he said, Richard, you know, I don't think this is the Richard I know, is it? And I burst into tears again. He said, "Richard, what do you think we should do about it?" And I sort of gasped through my tears, "I don't know." And he said, "How about we just give them back and we say nothing more?" That was an example of grace that still brings a lump to my throat today. And I suppose I grew up with that memory and with other memories that I had, knowing that we could all mess up. And I became a Christian when I was 14. I wanted to be a priest. I lost my faith by the time I was 18. I had lots of questions about God and science and stuff like this. I was a very good atheist at university. I became a teacher, initially of history, but then of religious education, because I recognized that the spiritual aspects, the things that were really important in life, weren't on the curriculum. Kindness was not rated on the curriculum. Your numeracy was. And actually, kindness is more important than numeracy. So I had that kind of conversation with myself and finally left teaching, called out, because God said, "Launch forth, and behold, I will make you a fisher of men, not a teacher of children." One of the catalysts in that was that when I was a religious education teacher, I recognized that the boys weren't listening to their parents, they weren't listening to their teachers, they certainly weren't listening to me. One of them said to me, "I don't want to be a monk." And I said, "No, Jim, you'll be a very bad monk." But I used to bring interesting people like ex-drug addicts, ex-alcoholics into my classroom so they could tell the children the dangers of the lifestyle that perhaps some of them were heading for.
Yeah.
And this was very successful. And I then had a crisis in my own life. My first marriage broke down. And I used to go to AA. And that's where I first really saw God work. I'd never seen God work before, not in church, not in anywhere else. But in AA, I did. I saw how love and community support transformed people's lives, even if it didn't have a name and was just called the God of your understanding or the higher power. That absolutely fascinated me. And when I left teaching, which I did fairly soon after this, I started working with drug addicts and alcoholic people in a Christian rehabilitation near where I lived. And that's where I met a lot of people who had come out of prison. And I couldn't understand why they'd been in prison for 5 years or 10 years and they need rehabilitation on the way out. So I asked them, what did you do in prison? He said, "Well, we didn't do much. We learned how to read." And that made me think, well, why are they teaching them how to read? I mean, that's important, but it's not the most important thing. And that still takes place in prison now. They have a huge premium on education and vocational training. They somehow think that if you teach people to read and teach people numeracy, you're going to make them better people. Well, you're not. You're just going to make them smarter crooks if nothing else has changed. And so that really was the thing that got me into it. And when I started getting involved in prison, I met a chap who had been on the Kairos ministry. And he was very interesting because he was actually in the prison and he was actually dealing drugs and doing all kinds of naughty things in prison. And I took him up to see the prison minister because he was talking about education, how important education was. And I said, "Steve, why didn't you tell him your story?" So he did. He said, "Well, actually, when I was in prison, I was doing 13 years for importing a large number of drugs. I was also running a drugs business, but I was doing a degree in business studies." And the minister said, "Well, that's wonderful, Steve. You were doing a degree. That would have been a very good thing to do, to use the facilities in the prison." And Steve said, "Well, would you want to know why I did that?" And I said, "Yes, I would." He said, "Well, I was doing this drugs business and I wanted to see if the Open University had any new ideas on how to make my drugs business more profitable."
Wow.
The minister then had to stop and said, "I see what the point you're making. You see, that chap came on Kairos during the time and went on to be a transformed model prisoner, went on eventually to become a PhD, and now advises Parliament on issues relating to prisons. That didn't take place in the maths department. That took place in the chapel with Jesus, because Jesus restores the brokenhearted. He puts people in their right mind, and Stephen was off his head until he met Jesus. So that's probably why I got into prison, isn't it?"
Wow, that's a powerful story. I feel like you're a little passionate about that, Richard. I love it. Really great. Could you tell me a little bit about Kairos Ministry International? You talked about that at the top of the show. Are there differences between what you do in the UK and what happens elsewhere? Because I know the prison structure is slightly different.
Kairos in the UK is a fairly recent arrival, so we're only actually working in five prisons in the UK. So
In America, they have three ministries. They have an adult prison ministry, they have a youth ministry, which is called Torch, and then they have a prison ministry for the wives and the female relatives of prisoners, which is called Caritas Outside. In England, we have managed to get the Torch or the Caritas Outside working. In England, one of the things that we had to do, they wouldn't allow us into the prison unless we had mixed gender teams. And in America, generally speaking, that isn't the case.
So you did also mention earlier about speaking to the men in the prisons. Does that mean that you haven't been able to get into any women's prisons in the UK?
We are in a women's prison in Northern Ireland. So we are in both sex prisons. In the women's prison, we just take a women's only team. But in the men's prisons, we take a mixed gender team. And that is actually allowed.
This is a bit of a sensitive question, but do you ever feel nervous or unsure of the people you serve in prison?
I did once. I remember going in the first time I went into Brixton, which is a London prison. And when we go in, we get partnered with individual people on the team. So each person who's coming on the team as a volunteer participant has one person who he kind of buddies with. During the actual ministry itself, we're on tables of nine people, six inmates and three team. But on their first day, we just have somebody who we kind of buddy up with. And there was this huge guy. He was 6'3" tall, about 6'3" wide. His arms were about the size of my thighs. He had a gold tooth, and he was a guy from the West Indies. So by the time he had his afro haircut, he was about 6'8". And it turned out when he arrived, he was completely psychotic from drugs poisoning. He was barking like a dog. He used to eat his meals on the floor. But eventually he came to Caritas. By this stage, he had been sort of mellowed. He had been taken off the drugs. But he was a huge, big fellow. And I have to say, I was somewhat intimidated by him, although I'm 6'3" myself. It was amazing to watch him as the anger and the toughness melted in the face of Jesus's love. He came in demanding cookies. He said that we were all hypocrites and stuff like this. But by the end of the week, he said he'd never had so much love in his life. And he was completely changed. The interesting thing is that 2 weeks later, a sex offender was invited into that prison and they had to find a place for him. Brixton at the time was double bunking, which had two prisoners in a cell. It was this guy who said, "I will have this man in my cell with me." That was an extraordinarily dangerous thing for him to do. But because he was 6'8", he thought he could look after himself, and he certainly could, and look after this sex offender. It's so interesting that he said he's done some terrible things, but so have I. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm on the same road as he is. So what he needs, I will give. It was an extraordinary event.
Amazing that that turned around so fast in his heart.
The great thing about prisons, if I might say so, is that the guys there know they've messed up. When my first marriage broke down, I went to a church, the church I sort of was on the edge of, and said, "I'd like to come in and speak to the minister because my life is at the moment in a bit of a mess." And the minister met me at the door and said, "Well, Richard, you come to the right place." And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Because God does messes. That is what he does." And I've never forgotten that. I've used that several times when I'm in prison. And forgiveness is the very big thing. And the men in prison know they need to be forgiven. They know that. They've messed up and their life is in a mess and they need to look for a new way, just like I did. And forgiveness, as I said, is a hugely big issue. And one of the guys came in on the Monday. He had been sexually abused by his father. And he said, "I will never forgive that guy. He's a horrible person and I just don't want anything to do with him." We did the Lord's Prayer. And in the Lord's Prayer, it says, God will forgive you if you can forgive those who have hurt you. And the big important thing about Caritas is on the Thursday, we have a forgiveness service when they actually write down the names of all those people who they have held in unforgiveness on the piece of paper, of bits of rice paper, and also they include anybody else they need to forgive, which might include, and usually does, their father, God, and themselves. Those names get written on the piece of paper. Then they take that piece of paper, they put it in water, and they stir it around, and the names disappear. Now, this guy came down the following morning, and he just looked different. And I said to him, "Jim, you look kind of different today." And he said, "Oh, there's a reason for that." And I said, "Tell me." He said, "You don't understand. Last night, I went to sleep for the first time in 27 years without hating my father." Something had happened in the atmosphere, in the spiritual atmosphere within his mind. he suddenly realized that his bitterness towards his father wasn't hurting his father, but was severely damaging him, and that God made it possible for him to forgive his father. No psychiatrist could understand these changes. This has to be God. We know it's God, and that's why it's so sad that prisoners in English prisons, they get 20 hours of maths, 20 hours of literacy, and 2 hours of God in the chapel per week. I think it's very sad. But they need to know that God loves them. He has a plan and purpose for them. He was weeping for them when they were hurt, and he was weeping for them when they were hurting people. And that's what they need to hear. And that new narrative is what turns them around. Plus the fact that the team themselves are volunteers. That itself impacts the men. One of them came up to me and said, Richard, I don't know what it is. I mean, we're here paying for our crimes, but I don't understand why you're here with your wife on teams spending a week of your time as volunteers unpaid with us because we're such rubbish. And I looked them straight and said, well, who told you you were rubbish? And in my book, you're worth it. And that may be the first time anybody's told they're worth anything for a very long time. Gradually, on the 5 days, they get a different narrative. They get a different view of who they are. They get a different view of who God is. They think that God is like a policeman coming to arrest them. And they suddenly realize that actually God loves them. He's been on their side. And if they can just open their hearts to allow him in, he can help them with their forgiveness. He can help them with their addictions. He can help them with the vision, because men die through lack of vision. This is the problem. They've never been given any vision. That's been kicked out of them. Their whole life is based around being able to survive because the people who should have loved them didn't. And so therefore they grew up saying, well, why should I care for anybody because nobody cared for me? It's that narrative. It's that basic blindness to the realities of life. And suddenly the eyes of the blind open, the ears of the deaf are opened, and they hear for the first time that they are precious and wonderfully made and that God has a plan and a purpose for them, and they start engaging with that plan and purpose. And that's beautiful to see. And I cannot tell you that working in the prison, it improves my faith. I mean, that's the thing about it. You know, I suddenly see it. I didn't see it in church. Church is a wonderful place where people can come in a crisis like I was. But in prison, the trajectory of change is so much sharper. They come in completely lost on the Monday. Steve was, he was selling drugs. By the Friday, they are radically changed. And that's why I believe this is so important. That's why I believe that the prisons really need to recognize that all the money that they spend on the so-called rehabilitation, cognitive behavioral therapy, that has a place. Psychology can give them an insight into why they're in a mess. But only Jesus can really give them the power to get out of the mess. And also, the advantage of coming to faith in prison, it means that when they leave prison, they can join a church and have the same kind of support that they had within the prison from each other. That's so important. If you have psychological treatment and you're away from your psychiatrist, you know you're in a way feeling very vulnerable again. But Jesus, the wonderful counselor, is always with them, just a prayer away. And they come to recognize that, and that's a huge change.
You're listening to God in the Ordinary with me, Sharon Tedford, and my guest, Richard Stevens. So, do Kairos have vision to be in more prisons? I wonder what it's like for you to approach a prison to introduce your ministry, because obviously you're explicitly Christian. Is it easy to start a new group in a new prison?
The problem has been that the multi-faith agenda has meant for some time when I started being involved in Kairos, they wouldn't let us in because we were Christian. They didn't want anything too Christian. They wanted it to be multi-faith. The reality is, of course, that nobody is multi-faith. You need to have a multi-faith chaplain. You need to have a Muslim imam for the Muslims. You need to have a rabbi for the Jews. And you need to have a Christian minister for the Christians. No individual person is multi-faith. And they now recognize that that's the way it's got to be in this particular area. But the real important thing is what Kairos can do for the prison. When we first got into one of the prisons in England, there was a big problem there because it was a maximum security prison and quite a lot of the prisoners there were absolutely at war with the prison service. and spitting, for example, in the face of a female Christian chaplain because A, she was female, B, she was a Christian, and C, she was a chaplain. I mean, that kind of disgusting behavior was going on. And of course, none of the men would dare come to church because they would be beaten up. This was happening. The congregation, which was normally about, 20 or 30, all right, was reduced to 10. This was the problem. And the new chaplain there invited us to come in to not just convert people into Christians, but to help build up a Christian community. And we came in, and within 2 years, that chapel attendance had gone from 10 to 50. It was the fastest growing church in the area, the prison chapel. Revival had taken place, and it was kick-started by the Charis ministry because we came to build a community, and that was the thing that changed. You see, because now a new person coming into the prison, if you came in, they said, well, you better join with us and we'll look after you. That was a veiled threat that if you didn't, you could be in trouble. But now the new people had an option. They could either join a brotherhood based on fear or the Christian fellowship that was established now in the wings through Charis based on love. The amount of violence changed, the attitudes changed. It became a much more pleasant place to be in, having been a terrifying place to be in. I got the idea that this could happen by finding out about a famous American prison, which I would love to just talk about for a moment, which is called Angola Prison. It was the worst prison in the American system in 1990 or whenever it was. A chap called Burl Cain became the warden there. They had 5,000 men, all doing 100-year sentences. It so happened that soon after Burl Cain became the warden there, he was a very strong Christian, the education department decided there was no point in educating these people because they were never going to get out, so they cancelled the education, whereupon Burl invited Charis in to come and give almost wall-to-wall five-day missions to his prisoners. And gradually, 50 at a time. And they had 4 or 5 missions a year. So they had 250 men went through that program a year in the first year, 250 in the second year. Suddenly he got a 10% Christian base in his prison. The impact of that was absolutely amazing. And now they have 400 prison chapel activities per calendar month in that prison. They have 5 chapels. It's quite extraordinary. And then Burl Cain said, well, what are we going to do now? We've got all these people. They've still got a long time to live. And then he had an idea, which I have taken on, that he should have a theological college behind the wire, allowing these men who've got long sentences to take 4 years, if they have the academic qualification to do it, and the personal impeccable prison record, they could apply to do a 4-year theological college behind the wire and become not prison chaplains, but prisoner priests. That has been my vision, and that vision is now taking place.
Wow, that's incredible. I love that you've dug into that, not just walked away from it.
I just got one other example, which I'd just love to share. I was at a prison conference in the States a couple of years ago, and I met a black guy. He was an absolutely amazing person. I told him who I was. I worked in Charis, and I said, are you a prison chaplain? He said, no, I'm not. I was a prisoner priest. I'm 77 years. I've just been released for something I did when I was 22. 30 years ago, he was on the first Charis in Angola prison. He had spent 30 years in a prison as a prisoner priest. When the chaplains go home at 5:30, he was there doing the business on the wings. Can you imagine how many people he brought to faith? He had more impact than I will ever have. No wonder he was shining.
No wonder he was shining. So you're saying that a prisoner priest is somebody who is still on the inside and is behaving as the Bible says, the priesthood of all believers and continuing to witness for Christ when the chaplain who wears the badge has gone home. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. He's a prisoner who has come through the theological colleges in several prisons, one in Sing Sing in New York, for example. We are starting our first one in Whitemore next year, where the men will still be a prisoner when they come out of the theological college because they've got a 20-year or 50-year sentence. But he's got a degree in theology, a theological training, and they are recognized now to be able to run services. I went to a prison in America, in Newton, Iowa, where the service was run by the prisoners. The band was the prisoners. The sermons were done by the prisoners. They were all prisoners. There were guards there. There were about 4 or 5 of them in a gymnasium which had 250 prisoners in. A quarter of the prison was on this program. It was extraordinary. I'd been to Bible college for a year. I'd never seen such attention being paid. And these guys knew, you see, that what they were learning was actually the thing their life depended on it. So this is a development. It's not specifically involved with Kairos, but it's the way that I think the prisons need to go. The prisons, when I first started, they were called HMP, meaning Her Majesty's Prisons. Well, my vision is that one day they'll be called His Majesty's Prisons. And I'm not talking about King Charles, I'm talking about Jesus.
Yes. Yeah, that's strong. That is strong. So, Richard, I don't know if you've noticed, but you have talked a lot about the transformative love of Jesus. And I just wonder whether seeing that transformative love in other men has done something to your heart. How has that affected you as a believer?
Hugely. Hugely. Because I've seen God at work. I have seen God change people's lives. And so many people don't. So many people just come to church and they know how to maintain a life, but I've seen the radical change. And that's what I believe very strongly we need to have in the churches. We need to have more testimonies and sometimes fewer sermons. Because if you had testimonies, that's what people get excited about. And that would get some of the men out from behind their Sunday papers to come to the church to hear a testimony. It's radically changed my life. It also has become my calling card. I can speak to anybody now on the street. And if they're begging it, I sit down beside them, buy them a coffee and say, tell me about it. And they say, well, you know, just come out of prison. And I say, well, so have I. And they cannot believe it. But as soon as I say that I worked in the prison chapel, they know that I'm safe. And that's a huge thing because my accent normally, for our American friends, you can probably hear that I sound rather posh. And that's the trouble with the church. You know, it's too white, it's too educated, it's too middle class, and in my case, I sound too posh. I would never have any impact in the darker parts of the city. That's why we've got to get the guys from the prisons, because they can do it. That's exactly the point. They will become the missionaries, and let's face it, I mean, if you look at the Bible, murderers have had a pretty good track record over the years. Moses was a murderer, David was a murderer, St. Paul was a murderer, Nicky Cruz was a murderer. Murderers do quite well if they get hold of Jesus. Why? Because those who've been forgiven much love much, and that's what I see, and that's changed my life. I can't hate anybody. If you've heard their backstory, you can't hate anybody. I also know that people, including myself, are more than my crime. Okay, I was a thief when I was 8, but that's not who I am. That's what I did. That's why I can go in with a lot of passion, because I know how important it is to change the people's narrative. And also in the church, I do what I call a ministry for the back row. So I meet the people who are coming into the church who need a hug, and I meet people who are possibly leaving the church unless they get a hug. And I don't necessarily mean a hug, I just mean a conversation.
Well, that's something that we can all do, both of those things, just meeting somebody where they are, sharing the love of Jesus. So, Richard, thank you. It's been really great to talk to you. If people are listening and itching to get involved, how can they get involved? Where can they find you? What kind of help is needed?
Well, I think the real thing is it's not really about Kairos. It's about Jesus in prison. And because Kairos in England is only operating in about two areas, near Belfast and around Cambridge, to get involved in prison by ringing up and finding out how you can come in as a volunteer. And the organisation with the biggest footprint in terms of prison across the country is Prison Fellowship, which is a fellowship of Christians who go in and run various ministries. That's how I got into prison in the first instance. But if there was a Kairos going, if you get onto the Kairos website, which is www.kairosprisonministry.org, and just put in an inquiry, I'll pick it up. And if we've got a program in the area, you'll be most welcome. What we basically need, I suppose, is we need men and women, but particularly men, to work on the teams. And if they're an ex-offender, ex-offenders, we welcome very much on the team. And that's one way. And the other way is financially blessing us or being part of our massive catering team that make all these cookies. That's probably some of the best ways of doing it. But I hope that helps.
That's really good. So if you really feel like I'm not sure that that's why God's calling me to go into the prison, you can make cookies. This is a really great ministry for you to do. That's actually the love of Jesus. That's what Richard said right at the beginning, that we can't talk about the love of God without showing it. And this is how they feed people with the love of God. Richard, I have been so delighted to talk to you. I've learned a lot of things today. I feel challenged to get out and speak to people and share the love of Jesus. Thank you so much for joining us today on God in the Ordinary.
Bless you. You take care.
You've been listening to God in the Ordinary with me, Sharon Tedford, and my guest, Kairos Prison Ministry International UK Chairman, Richard Stevens. You can find out more at kairosprisonministry.org.
For our show notes, go to 61-things.com. This podcast is a Wise Word Radio 61 Things co-production. We pray that you're encouraged to reveal God in your everyday.